Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Tim Berry is our guest. Tim's going to have an amazing story about negotiating with a TV network to get an audio feed to his radio network. They came to an agreement eventually. It's all coming up next on TWRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, keeping you connected with your community with support and webinars, online at nautel.com/webinars. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone, this funny-looking one, to the light bulb at the top of the tower, and there she blows right there. That's one of those big 300-millimeter code beacons modified with low-wattage LED lamps. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Delighted to be here. We're starting our second chapter of This Week in Radio Tech. The first chapter lasted 10 and a half years, and it was 500 episodes long. The second chapter, well, Chris Tobin said he'd be with us for another 500 episodes, so we're gonna try that. We're going to continue on for 10 more years. It's This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we do talk about radio technology, and we've got a good show today because we're going to talk about some things that matter in terms of getting remotes set up and an engineer's new challenges as he moves into a new job and kind of figuring his way out. We'll get to our guest in just a minute. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, as usual, in the Telos Alliance studio. You can see all the gear and lights around me here. Thanks a lot to the Telos Alliance for providing a rack full of gear. And on the other side of the monitor, oh my goodness, I have an Omni 11 and some MPX nodes and just a whole bunch of gear. So it's pretty cool stuff. And I appreciate Telos giving me an hour on Thursdays to take off from work and talk to you guys. So now let's talk to one of my favorite people in New York City. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Hi, thank you, Kirk. Yes, today I'm not on top of a building, a rooftop, and overseeing the skyline. It's just a small, quiet Soho location here in Manhattan. So I'm good. Just taking it easy. Nice breeze, blue skies. It's good. Good stuff.
So what's the over-under on what floor you're on today?
Today's floor is floor number 15.
15?
Okay. About 150 feet above the street level, so I have a nice view of the avenue, side streets, a bodega, otherwise known as a small delicatessen coffee shop. And there's a Szechuan restaurant. Ooh, there's the Lebanese restaurant. That's good stuff. Good stuff. And there's a few pizzerias. Those have been doing very well lately.
We tend to steer clear of politics on the show and keep it all on tech, but I'm a little bit curious about how you're feeling about your personal safety walking around New York. We see viral videos of people hitting people with baseball bats, and I'm sure they're not everyday occurrences. But how's your life walking around and getting to the subway and going where you got to go?
Oh, it's just fine. It's like that scene in Casablanca where the Germans talk about marching in on New York City, and Humphrey Bogart's character simply says, "There are some neighborhoods in New York you may not want to go to." Not a problem here. You know what? If you're a native New Yorker as I am, you know exactly what to do, how to handle yourself, and if you give the appearance of you're in control, nobody bothers you. I've already had the protesters coming by in the neighborhood several times in the last 3 months. Some strange people saying things to me, and I was like, "Hey, go about your business. There's plenty of places you can get what you need. You don't have to bother me."
Yeah. Look like you're in control. That often works. Hey, Chris, before we get to our guest, I got something that we need to chat about real quick, and that is our friends at Nautel, and they're continuing talks about their transmission talk. It's Transmission Talk Tuesday. It's these roundtable discussions that now going on through July. And next week, that's July the 14th at 12 noon Eastern time, the discussion is going to be about something that's really important and often misunderstood, and that's grounding and lightning protection. Now, I got to tell you, Chris, as you may know, Nautel kind of wrote the book on this. It's either in the back of the manuals or you can get it separately online. But Nautel did years of research and wrote an excellent, excellent book pamphlet, if maybe it's a pamphlet, a booklet on grounding and lightning protection. They're going to be bringing that up to date and telling you about it in a live roundtable discussion that's coming up Tuesday, July 14th, Tuesday of next week. And since it's a roundtable, your questions can get answered. So if there's something you missed, if you feel like, hey, I'm not quite getting this particular aspect of grounding and lightning protection. What do you mean my transmitter is a giant fuse if I don't build my transmitter site correctly? Jeff Welton is going to be there. Also going to be talking about ferrites, not the little furry animals, but Chris, would you like to talk about ferrites, Chris?
Yes, ferrites. They're actually very handy little ferromagnetic materials. It's iron ore. It's pretty cool stuff. I use it on a lot of equipment. Both audio and RF, and if you use it properly, because if you don't, you will find out that they do heat up and explode. It does what it has to. It does prevent the discharge of lightning. Now, remember, I was at a seminar 2 years ago now? 2 years ago up in Canada, Toronto, at a CCBE conference. They had a whole session on lightning protection, understanding it, and the gentleman who presented it was well-learned, and it was fascinating, some of the images, and the way, as he put it, you see this grounding piece here? Yeah, it's very nice, isn't it? That grounding wire is at right angle, and it goes around the corner and along the floor, and it goes to the back of the transmitter. Yeah, lightning doesn't care about the right angles. It goes from point A to point B. It'll jump over there. He goes, and then he shows, let me show you the next slide. Next slide, which was a cell site, which had a very nice grounding system and stuff and everything. Yeah, the burn marks were a straight line right from the entry point to the cabinet. And the floor was the strap and the ground. So he goes, the grounding like this does work for certain things, but for lightning protection, you need to do it at the outside of the building. So that's the key. And some of the stuff he talked about, how he showed it, was fascinating. And I remember Nortel was at this event as well, so Jeff and the others, other group of folks, they talked about it. They're like, oh, yeah, this stuff is definitely what we encounter all the time. And, remember, Nortel's work goes beyond, it's before broadcast. They were involved in maritime stuff and doing other things. So they got years of hostile environments for electrical discharge, okay, under their belt. So, bringing the broadcasters have lightning rods for transmitter sites. And you say, okay, here's what we've learned on this smaller size stuff. Here's what you should do on the larger towers. So, it's a great seminar, great opportunity. Jeff and the guests he brings in are well-learned on all the stuff and ask questions. And ask the craziest thing you might think of. Just say, well, what if this? Listen to the answer. Listen to how they get to the answer. And you'll be like, oh, I never thought of it that way. And that's the best part about the seminars. They make you think from a different perspective, not just what the book says.
I'm looking forward to separating wives' tales from what actually works, because there's theory behind it that stays constant. The website is nautel.com/webinars. Nautel.com/webinars. And that every Tuesday, Transmission Talk Tuesday. So sign up for next week's. Go ahead and sign up now. I mean, if you need to just, open the window on your keyboard, on your computer and sign up, go ahead and do it. And that way you'll get a confirmation email and a link to join the webinar for next Tuesday. Okay. Hey, let's bring in our guest. I'm so excited. I've known Tim Berry for some years, and we never have gotten to spend much time together. I've done a couple of SBE meetings in the Knoxville, Tennessee area, and that's where Tim is from. So, Tim Berry, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Oh, I'm pleased that you found some time to come be with us. And Tim, we're going to talk about some interesting topics today. And one of those, I think, could be the most interesting because I kind of envy the position that you've been in, and that is doing engineering work for the Vol network. Now, if you're not a Tennessean or in a state immediately affected by the mighty Tennessee Vols, if you haven't had your college team whipped by the Tennessee Vols, maybe you haven't heard of them, but the Vols are the name of the Volunteers. The Vols are the name of the team for the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, UTK. And so, Tim, give us a little bit of overview of getting involved with the Vol network and what you guys do.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the Vol network is the rights holder for all of University of Tennessee sports broadcasts, football, basketball, women's basketball, baseball, and softball. The Vol Network actually started in the 50s. It was the first announcer was Lindsey Nelson, that some of you may remember, who called Major League Baseball games later in his career. As a matter of fact, our baseball stadium is named after Lindsey. I started with the Vol Network actually as a studio person when I went to work for WIVK Radio in 1986. There has obviously, for whatever happens in the field, there has to be someone at the studio to make sure that all the connections are made and the feed is going to the right places. So I did that for 6 years until the summer of 92, worked with the legendary John Ward, who was a Hall of Fame broadcaster, still well revered in the state of Tennessee, has things named after him. John and I worked together, and I became the full-time, the on-site guy in the summer of 1992. Worked with John till he retired in 98, and I've been with Bob Kessling ever since. It's been a fun ride.
And you're involved with all these different sports, whether it's what you said, what, football, basketball. Is that men's and women's or just women's basketball?
No, it is men's and women's, yes.
All right. And you said baseball was involved as well?
Yes,
did I
miss? Baseball and softball.
Softball. Okay. Good deal. Yes. And you know, of course, when I go, of course, I haven't lately, but when I talk to my friends, whether it's, you know, friends from my social circle or church or whatever, everybody's got their favorite SEC team, but the vast majority of them around here, they kind of forget about Vanderbilt. I mean, some, you know, they rah-rah for Vanderbilt, but they know going to get beat probably. But they're Vol fans. Oh my gosh. There's more orange around here in Nashville. It seems like there's almost as much as there is in Knoxville. I take it you need to be a Vol fan yourself, right?
I am, have been since I was quite young. My grandfather was a state senator, and I went to football games with him very early on. Then for a period of time before I was involved in radio full time, I was there. I was there as a kid selling Cokes, you know, one of the vendors. And then for a small period of time, I was in law enforcement and was there as a Knox County Reserve Sheriff's Officer. And then got involved with the Vol, with the radio side of things through the Vol Network in 1986.
Well, you do other things too, and we'll get to those. But you do day-to-day broadcast engineering, well, these days at a public radio station, yeah?
Yes, sir. I am the chief engineer of WUOT-FM. That's the office that I'm in that you see here. It is the University of Tennessee's NPR affiliate, celebrating its 70th anniversary last year. Very happy to be here. This is actually my second stint at WUOT. It was interrupted by a 20-year stint as chief engineer for the Cumulus cluster of stations here in Knoxville. When I was there, we started off as Dick Broadcasting, family-owned. Then we're purchased by Citadel, and then Citadel, of course, was purchased by Cumulus. And I returned back to the university in July of 2017.
I want to hit something that you mentioned, and that is you mentioned the call letters WIVK. Those are such classic call letters for anybody who's listened to radio around Tennessee. What was so famous about WIVK? And by the way, back when I was a contract engineer in Memphis – in the 1990s, early 90s, I had a WIVK banner hanging up in my office. I don't know where I got it, but it was a big old IVK banner. Tell me about that station.
WIVK went on the air as a 1,000-watt AM daytimer in 1953. James Dick put it on the air. He had to borrow money. He was originally a sales representative for a local TV station here. It stayed on the air as a kilowatt daytimer from 1953 until 1966, I believe it was. He sought and got permission from the FCC to change from 860 to 850. When he went to 850, he also got a little power increase that brought him to 50,000 watts. The next year after that, they were issued the construction permit for what was then WIVK-FM. It was on the air on a 300-foot tower just west of downtown Knoxville. It stayed on the air there until 1973 or 4. I believe it was 1974. And then the site was built where they're presently at, which is on Bluff Mountain just outside of Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Runs 100 kilowatts. I think the height above average terrain is right about 2,000 feet. What makes WIBK special? That heritage, that history, the fact that for years WIBK has staked its reputation on super serving its audience. They have a news department. For years, they had an airborne traffic reporter. Mm. If something happens in the Knoxville and East Tennessee area, whether it's weather related, whether it's an unfortunate crime or whatever is newsworthy, WIBK had and does have the facilities and the people to go out and cover that. And that's, at least in my opinion, what made it special. I grew up listening to him as a little boy and dreamed and idolized at the chance to perhaps maybe someday work for him. And I was blessed to spend 20 years as their chief engineer.
That's awesome. And I, a few months ago, I was at our cabin in the Pigeon Forge, Gatlinburg area. And I drove up to that mountain, that Bluff Mountain, and, flew my drone around that tower for WIVK. I've posted a couple pictures on Facebook of that, but I should do a little video production. But what a beautiful sight that is. And because it's on that mountain, the tower itself doesn't have to be all that high to give you 2,000 feet above average terrain. So that's a really impressive sight.
It's a 330-foot tower. There's another broadcast facility up there as well that's just to the immediate north of it. It's a C with a power penalty. It's a 15 kilowatts. But yeah, the signal is quite outstanding. WIVK can be heard into the Carolinas, into Kentucky, into Virginia, west on Interstate 40, practically to Cookeville. It's a big stick.
If you want to know about terrain, let's say you're a listener to this show and you live in a fairly flat area. My goodness, if you go on to one of the sites where you can look at a Longley Rice map or even just a standard coverage map of where WIVK covers, you will begin to understand the mountains of East Tennessee, because you'll see coverage, no coverage, coverage, no coverage. And indeed, what's kind of funny, what's that?
I said, indeed, the mountains can be a blessing. They can be a curse. We deal more with multipath in our area than probably most folks in flat territories do.
Yeah.
Antennas, you know, in other areas to make your ERP can usually be, 10, 12 elements. But in our area, we need the power, not the antenna gain. WIVK is a 5-bay.
Yeah. And in fact, our cabin is on the wrong side of a mountain to pick you up. And yet in our downstairs game room, the FM radio that's down there, WIVK is about the only station we can pick up. So you got some great coverage.
Yeah. Not surprised.
Not surprised at all. All right. So, Tim, when we're going to talk about one of our sponsors here for a minute. When we come back, I want to talk about your work with the Vol Network and the technology that you began with when you kind of went full time there in the early 90s, and how that technology has moved. So you, whatever you started with back then through early digital stuff and what you're doing now to make sure that that ball games are on the air, they're reliable. There's a lot of money riding on these Vol Network ball games. I know, because the spots are expensive and there's a lot of them. So there's a lot riding on your responsibility there. Hey, it's This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. Chris Tobin's along, and we're talking to Tim Berry. This product right here is something that I'll bet you Tim is familiar with. We should add, Tim, you know what this thing is? This Max Connect. You seen that?
Absolutely, I do. Absolutely, yeah. I do.
Makes a good backup, doesn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah, this is the Max Connect wireless service, and this looks like a standard 4G modem. This one's from Cradlepoint. There are others that Max Connect uses, but what's key here is not the modem itself. There are several that work just fine, but what's key is the service from the SIM cards inside. Max Connect is a data provider. They're a network, and when you sign up for Max Connect wireless, you're signing up for 4G LTE data. But guess what? It's not data that, you know, your neighbor's getting on his or her cell phone. You get prioritized data, prioritized over all the other people around, except for first responders. So let's say that you're Tim Berry and you're in the middle of a Vol football game. You got a Neyland Stadium is just chock full of people, and it's halftime. They're all checking their Facebook and sending messages and pictures and having a good time. What are you going to do to get some data to eke through the cellular network? Well, the answer is Max Connect Wireless, because you can get data through. You have reserved data that's reserved just for you, and your packets will get through. Chris Tobin can attest to this too. Chris, you do remotes with Sam Wu. Tell me a bit about your experience getting data where you wouldn't otherwise get some.
It has saved us on many occasions with the sports broadcast. Yes, indeed. It's very handy, and it's nice that they had the two SIM card option, because there are places where sometimes one carrier is better than the other. And to attest to the MaxConnect's ease of use, you know, the 500th episode of Twerk, I did it all with a MaxConnect connection. And I challenge anyone to look at a video and say, oh, it's not, that can't be a cellular connection. And it was. High on top of a building, out in a hostile environment. It was hot and humid.
It turns out that same show, I had a hostile environment, but the problem was me. Well, it was the laptop. So check out MaxConnectWireless.com. Go check it out there. It's spelled funny, so you want to write it down, or I'll put it in the show notes. Max with two X's, connect with a K, wireless.com. And you get your choice of T-Mobile, AT&T, or Verizon. And it works all over the U.S. It works in Canada, too. Josh Bone is a broadcast engineer. He owns the company, and he's done a great job of making this work for broadcasters. All right, it's episode 501 of This Week in Radio Tech. We're talking to Tim Berry. Tim's the chief engineer over at WUOT-FM, University of Tennessee, UOT. But right now we're going to talk about the Vol Network. And Tim, talk about technology. What were things like when you were starting out with the Vol Network? How did you reliably get audio from the stadium back to the broadcast center?
Well, shortly after DIRT, when I started, we were using either just a straight coupled telephone feed or a single line Comrex frequency extender, if anybody remembers those. I took a 2500 series desk phone, bought a 600 ohm 1-to-1 transformer that you could get down at your friendly neighborhood Radio Shack, and put it across the pair coming in. We would call the coupler on the other end, make the connection, flip the switch, and basically couple audio through that 600 ohm transformer into the phone line. And it sounded about like what you would expect. The Comrex single line frequency extender helped that. It helped get some low end into the audio, not so much high end. Then we graduated up to the two line Comrex, where if those weren't aligned just right, we would sound like Donald Duck with a speech impediment. But you set the levels on those, and you balanced it with the receive unit at the studio. Comrex later came out with a three-line device that really had pretty good audio. We graduated from the Comrexes and along mixed along in there, especially for my home games, were Marty transmitters. I could not install a Marty at the arena or the stadium. I actually installed it here at the communications building in the university where I'm at now, and had the campus phone guys ran dry pairs over to the Marty so that I could get a Marty shot out of the campus, and that worked out real well. After that, we had a short stint of time with Switch 56, but basically since about 1992 until just very recently, it's been ISDN. When we started, the ISDNs were so rare and so expensive that we would split the circuit. The home team would get 56 or 64K, and the visitors would take 56 or 64K. And you had to have, of course, a terminal unit that would handle two codecs. We used ADTRANS at that time. And I still do. And we would then split that signal, and that would give us both about a 6.5 or 7 kilohertz quality audio. Then, as ISDNs became more commonplace, each team had its own ISDN, and I went from using 56 or 64 kilobits to 128 kilobits. And that was my method of choice and has been since probably the mid-90s until just very recently. And as all of us know that do remotes or live events, ISDN is being forced into obsolescence. I say that with a little bit of politics in mind, because I think it could have lasted longer, personally. The reason why I, as well as other broadcasters, loved ISDN so much was because even though it was only 128K of data, it was my data. I didn't have to share it with anybody. And with an IP-based connection, depending on how far down the food chain you are and what your QoS is, you may be sharing that data, and it may come back to haunt you. First time I used an IP codec at the Coach's Show, everything was lovely until people started tweeting their pictures with the coach over the same internet that I was trying to do a broadcast with. That didn't go well. But as of at least this year, I'm going to be on an IP codec exclusively. I will use two codecs, and what I will try to do is find two different means to have a connection back to our flagship studio. One maybe by the fixed Ethernet on campus. If they offer a DSL connection or something through the local telco, I would use that for my second choice. Or I'm going to use a device like the MaxConnect, so that I have two different means to get that audio from wherever the event venue is back to the studio. As you referenced, Kirk, being off the air is really not an option. So that's what we do. Yeah. I'm also still able to use POTS codecs, such as the Tyline POTS, or in my case, the Comrex Blue Box, as a hot standby. We still have good quality telco circuits here on campus, and most of the venues that we travel to do. Occasionally, you'll find a place that's IP only, but most of the time, we can still get decent telco. We also, in amongst the those of us in the Southeastern Conference, the SEC schools, we have a reciprocal website. I actually created and built the website. It's called secradiorecip.com, and we share information about our school's vital statistics, if you will, that are needed when you do a game broadcast. For example, on our football page, not only do we have things like, yes, we have an IP connection, yes, we do have ISDN, here are the SPIDs, here are the switch information you need. We also have things like the frequency coordinator. The Southeastern Conference does, like the NFL does, and mandates frequency coordination in advance for any RF devices, which I highly recommend in case anybody out there is not. We also have the information on there about who to contact when you get to the stadium, which gate are you going in, when will the stadium be locked down on Friday evening for a football game, for security reasons. And this website has turned out to be quite handy for broadcast things directly, and things that are related to broadcast, like, you know, who do I see if I have a problem with my IP connection, or who do I see to get me into the facility? You know, it also has the home engineer's name and contact information in case you needed to contact them. And it's worked out really nice. That's something I did in the, I think probably the late 90s, early 2000, was build that website, and it's helped out a lot.
That's amazing. And the fact that you're so reciprocal, in my early days of engineering, and Chris, maybe you could speak to this too. We seem to have a hard time, getting a lot of reciprocity going for visiting teams. You know, sure, we'd go somewhere. We'd love it if the people there could provide us with a phone line, or an ISDN line or something like that, or somehow make it easy for us to do that. Now, I think in the world of IP, yes, there's a few downsides, such as you might be sharing with other people. You may not get the bandwidth that you want. Well, more on that in a minute, but it is easier to share that and to make it available for everybody. And they're very likely to get what they need these days. Chris, what's been your experience in terms of reciprocity for people visiting people for broadcast?
Well, sadly, most of the venues are now managed and operated by companies that have no understanding of the relationship of the broadcast community that's relaying the content, which is their games, out to their to the fans. And what's happened is it's just become basically it's more than just a business model. It's become just, well, we don't worry about these. You know, I don't understand what you have to worry about this for. You just plug in here, whatever. Leave me alone. I remember working at, you know, Yankee Stadium, Shea Stadium, now Citi Field, Giant Stadium, and other venues here in New York City area, where for many years we knew the people inside. You can contact somebody even at the at the league level, at the team back office, if you will. Okay, so call up, say, hey Bob, it's Chris from such and such station. We're doing it. We got the game this week. Just want to let you know we have a visiting team coming in, broadcast group, and they're going to be in the booth next to us for the visitors. But there's a problem. The booth looks like it's under renovation. Do you know anything about it? And they would be, he would be like, no, I don't. But you know what? Call so and so in ops. They'll tell you what's going on. Because yes, we've been doing some changes. Boom. Today, you're lucky you can get that. Now what you get is submit a form at the website, and then the contractor that's working on that project will get back to you. Meanwhile, if you've got 72 hours before the game, you're like, I don't know if they understand the mission-critical thinking. So, yes, today, nowadays, you're on your own. If you've got to visit a venue, you better call in advance. If you can, make friends with the home team radio station and talk to the engineer and say, hey, listen, Jack, come to town, and we're going to be, we're the guys we're going to be playing against, but can you just give me some insight? What do I need to watch out for? Or, can you lend a hand? And, the professional courtesy part that we all do as engineers. I mean, many of us in the market help each other out when there's transmitter trouble. Does anybody call and say, oh, by the way, I call my GM and let them know I'm doing this? Yeah, I think not. So give a call. Just say, hey, I'm coming to town. I used to get calls all the time when I worked at ABC and the CBS stations here in New York City. I get calls from the visiting affiliates and say, hey, we're coming to cover the Yankees. They're playing the Blue Jays. I don't know anything about the stadium setup. What can you tell me? I'd be like, yeah, sure, no problem. You call this guy, blah, 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 tell him that I recommend you talk to him, and just be prepared to pay because you're coming from out of town, so you don't have anything in place. And that's it. And never had anybody call up in a panic. They were like, thank you very much, it worked. If you can do that, that's probably the best way to go about it. Nowadays, it's very difficult. I'd say 20 years ago, you could easily call up a venue or go anywhere and be, oh, here we are, visiting team, visiting broadcaster, yes. Here's your booth, here are provisions, have at it. Today, there's an empty booth, you want an IP? You want Ethernet? Yeah, you got to contact our telecom contractor. They're going to, then you submit a form and pay for that. So you can have 5 megabits a second for $10,000 for 2 days. Yes, there you go.
Oh, jeez.
That's not just NAB, but it's everywhere else. Yeah.
Chris, it sounds like you need to come to Knoxville, and I'll meet you there, and we'll experience some of Tim's Southern hospitality for visiting teams. Would that describe it, Tim?
Trust me. Yeah, it's not everywhere is like this, but a lot of places are turning into it. And when I was traveling, I mean, I know in the South, right? I'll say in the Southern Sun Belt states where I traveled, great hospitality, great reciprocity, never an issue. Other places where it's really competitive, I guess on the business level, you call it, the telecom companies got a little crazy. They're the ones that get in there, and once they take over, that's it.
So, Kurt, I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
The Broadcasters Association for the Southeastern Conference was actually started by John Ward, our famous Vol Network broadcaster for 30 plus years. And he did that for that very reason. When we travel back and forth to venues in the conference, broadcasters would have to order their own circuits. And so the idea was that if we installed what we needed for our broadcast, as well as what we needed for the visitors' broadcast, that way, when we travel to their venue, those facilities would be waiting on us as well. And you mentioned traveling to New York. The Tennessee basketball team played in Madison Square Garden a few years back, and we had to do our coaches show called Vol Calls on the road while we were there. And a huge shout out to Alex Roman, who was the engineer at WABC at the time. He not only made a studio available for us, he connected us up with via ISDN and internet. We were in the same control room that the gentleman that does the oldies, and I can't, his name just immediately left me. True Oldies Channel, Scott Shannon. We were in his studio, and he made everything work for us, and it was great. But to get back to live venues like that, if teams are playing each other on a regular basis, it behooves them to work out an arrangement like this because, yeah, sure, they're going to come use the equipment at your venue, but at some point you're going to travel to their venue and be nice for the same thing to happen. And for the most part, for completely in our conference, but for the most part in the other places I've traveled, it's been because our team is playing their team in a home-and-home arrangement. So it behooves the visiting folks to our venue to be able to accommodate us when we come to theirs.
Is when you do this reciprocity thing, is there a cost to the visiting team, or have they taken care of their costs by providing you reciprocity at their place?
If we're traveling to their venue, we would expect reciprocity for no additional cost. If we are playing a team that is coming to what we call a bye game, where the team is coming to play us at our home place, we're not going to their venue and they're being paid a sum to come here, we will typically ask their broadcasters for a small broadcast rights fee. That's handled way up the food chain for me. It has nothing to do with the engineer, but they will ask for that just to cover the cost of the circuit, because up until this year, we were providing ISDNs at all of our venues, and that is not cheap. And as is typical on a lot of universities, this department charges that department for whatever that department needs, which includes internet access. So we have to pay for that as well. And it works out well, because the fees are not high. And certainly if we're traveling to their venue, we're going to make all of our accommodations to help them here in the hopes that they'll help us when we travel there.
That seems like a good policy. And even back doing high school sports, that was more of what I was involved with. That sure seemed like it would be convenient. ISDN might be, it's a little inconvenient to pay for an ISDN line for the whole season. I think that's one of the benefits of IP, especially, and I realize not everybody can get it, but if you can get a couple hundred megabits up to a gigabit, which you can nowadays in so many areas, then that's got to be enough for everybody to share in that and not really have a problem. If you can have that. Now, sure, if you've got a line coming in and you're getting 10 megabits per second off a university switch, yeah, that could be a problem. And I realize a lot of times you're dealing with a campus IT network and you don't have any choice. Hey, can't I bring Xfinity or AT&T or Verizon in here? No, you can't. You got to go through our switch. Well, then you got to have that relationship with the university and make sure you're getting the bandwidth that you need when you come in. Is it like what I'm describing, Tim, or how's the relationship that people have to deal with at different universities to get that bandwidth?
Well, first of all, I will say at our university, the IT folks here are awesome. There are some campuses, for I'm sure justifiable reasons, that require you to register your codec, the MAC address of it, with their IT folks. And we note that on on the SEC reciprocal website, so that folks that are traveling to this area or to that area, wherever that area may be, will know that you need to do that in advance. Don't show up, 2 hours before airtime and then wonder why your codec won't connect. So we try to hit that off in advance. For the most part, the campuses that I've dealt with, we're on their campus network. Sometimes we do have to register. Most of them understand the quality of the QoS that we have to constantly stream a broadcast. And you're right, what you mentioned earlier, it has improved over the years. It's actually gotten better. And I would say that we, within the last year or so, have had IP connections that would rival my nice 128K ISDN that I was so fond of. The only downfalls is if you arrive at a venue in which you don't know what the registration process is, or if for some reason we've actually had this a time or two where the codec and the switch just simply didn't talk to each other. Doesn't happen a lot. And most of the engineers that I've dealt with, if you had a problem such as that, they may have a spare codec laying around. They'll work with you. They'll do something to help you get on the air. I've been as late as 30 seconds before the opening billboard having a connection that I trusted reliably. That was because the SPID numbers I was given on the ISDN circuit were transposed. We did make it on. Nobody was any the wiser. Shed a few pounds and sweated a lot, but everything was okay.
That's a good 30 seconds. Ooh, yeah, we might want to share a couple of pucker factor stories here after our next announcement. This week in Radio Tech, it's Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin, and we're talking to Tim Berry from Knoxville, Tennessee. He's the chief engineer over WUOT. We'll talk about that also. And he's also, WOT was actually an early adopter of audio over IP. And they got onto the Axia bandwagon years and years ago and have enjoyed that. I've gotten to visit them over there. Hey, our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by Broadcasters General Store. The website is bgs.cc. And at BGS, you can just get everything broadcast. And this is one of the things that you can get. This is the new Henry Superlight. It is a LED tally light controller. Now, more and more new broadcast studios aren't using 110-volt lighting for their on-air tally lights or for the light that would be a ring around your microphone. On your mic arm, and you can control them by supplying them with low voltage and low current to light up an LED. Well, the Henry Superlight is a beautiful box that just helps you make all that happen easily. It has built in for you the inputs and outputs that you need. It's got a 12-volt power supply, comes with it, and then you can give it control coming into there, the V and the N, hook up the LED to those terminals that is shown right there, and then it does have also relay outputs, normally open and normally closed. So it's got two sets of normally open, normally closed relay contacts. Then you see those RJ45 jacks in the middle. Now, I wouldn't say there's real intelligence there, but what there is convenience. You can wire a number of these one after another. And I'm going to show you an example here. I'm going to hold this piece of paper up to the camera. This is part of the brochure that comes with it. You see, you can use it in a single studio situation, but you can also use it in a multi-studio situation. And it's really easy to wire because you get to pick which pairs are used. Oh, thank you, Suncast, for moving that down. You get to choose which pairs are used for each studio. And that means at least that white block over at the left there, that multi-studio block, that could be something like, for example, an Axia GPIO node. So you could have several different outputs from that, a collector to ground closures, and you could hook up an RJ45 after you adapt it and run it serially, series it from one super light to another, and you can choose which pair is the on-air light for that studio. It makes really efficient use of the GPIOs on something like an Axia X node. And it also makes wiring easy for you. You just run one Cat5 cable from studio to studio to hook up the super light and hook it to your studio on-air light. It's a really convenient way to do it. You know, Hank Landsberg is the inventor of all this Henry engineering stuff, and he really has his finger on the pulse of what we as engineers need. So you ought to check out his website, henryeng.com, and you can buy all of Henry's stuff from Broadcasters General Store. That website, bgs.cc, or you can call them and they answer the phone, and they're just super to deal with. 352-622-7700. I've been dialing that number since the early 1990s and buying from Broadcasters General Store. 352-622-7700. Thanks a lot to both Hank Landsberg, Henry Engineering, with the Super Light, the replace. It's kind of the replacement, for the Super Relay, the Super Light. And also thanks to Broadcasters General Store for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Please patronize them and buy their stuff. Good stuff. All right, it's Kirk Harnack, episode number 501 of This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tobin's along, 15 stories above street level. Woo! It's like being on a tower. And our guest is Tim Berry with WUOT. Tim, I kind of wanted to wrap up before we move on to other engineering issues, other things with the Vol network. You said that nowadays you're using your IP codecs, but you've got backup with a POTS codec. What kind of IP codec are you using? What algorithm are you typically using with these broadcasts?
We use Comrex Access. Typically, I try to run an AAC algorithm if I can, and most places I've been able to. There's been a couple of places that I've had to go with a lesser algorithm, something equivalent to the G.722 that will be familiar to everyone. But for the most part, it's worked rather well.
I'm a little curious. Now, I'm a big fan of the AAC family of codecs. Let me ask, are your broadcasts in mono, or do you provide a stereo feed back to the network?
We broadcast in mono. If I were able to provide a stereo crowd feed, I would probably consider the broadcast in stereo. But truthfully, particularly when it comes to uplinking our broadcast and the fact that there's only our uplink facilities responsible for quite a few schools. And I'm sure they don't have the bandwidth that, or they would not like to have to share the bandwidth that it would take to do all those in stereo. We do a mono mix, and I run a Mackie 24 channel console, and yes, I fill up all 24 channels with various things from our announcer talent headsets. I always try to make nice with the TV production guys. And we usually have a deal where they would like to have our announcer's audio in case there's a scoring play or something special that they want to hear. You know, this is how it sounded to the Tennessee fan. And in exchange for that, they share with us our crowd, their crowd feed, which I can't do with a limited number of time and staff that I have. But, you know, the TV guys deploy multiple parabolic dish microphones on the field, all of which are pointed to where the ball is snapped, or in the basketball terms, you know, on the floor. So you hear the squeaking shoes, the bouncing ball, and the bucket sound. So I always try to get that because I feel like that makes our broadcast sound better. It lets the listener, you know, feel like he's actually at the game. And I've done that for years. The first time I did it to an air talent and I brought it up, it surprised him quite a bit. He kind of caught his breath, but it just makes our broadcast sound better. And of course, we have the other audiences.
I'm amazed that you have this great relationship with the TV people such that they'll give you a feed of the, you know, the field mics. That, I mean, that's terrific. What great cooperation that is.
It sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. Most of the time it does. I traveled to a particular venue out west where the producer out there said, "Oh, we don't give crowd feed away. We sell it." I said, "Well, that's fine. I'll take one for the team. How much are you going to want to sell it for?" And we bantered back and forth for a minute. And it was a three-letter network that I won't mention. But at the time, they had the rights to Southeastern Conference games. And I reminded him that at some point he would be coming back to my venue, and that, you know, if he wanted to play hardball and wanted to be of the attitude that he had, I reminded him that, you know, he could have two tin cans and a string for a referee's feed when he comes to our venue if he so chose to be such a jerk. And he said, "The NCAA requires you to give me that feed." I said, "Yes, they do, but they don't say a darn thing about what it's going to sound like now, do they?" And they, you know, we came to an agreement. His audio production person showed up at the doorstep to my booth about 5 minutes later and literally threw a coiled XLR cable at me and said, "Here's your blankety blank crowd feed." But that was absolutely the worst. Most of the time, yeah, those guys are great. And they like to have our audio because it gives the TV viewers a different perspective. And in exchange for that, they're usually almost always willing to share their crowd feed. And a lot of the games that are being produced, a lot of the basketball games that are being produced with the network that has the rights to the SEC games are produced internally. So it's produced on your campus. And those guys you see day in and day out. So make nice with them and they'll certainly take care of you.
I have an appreciation, Tim, for the Southern gentlemanly way that that some people can negotiate and drive a hard bargain.
Oh, that's a story that's been passed down through Vol Network lore. I had the general manager of the network with me at the time that this happened, and he still tells that story with great joy.
So I do have a question about codecs. You mentioned that you like to use the AAC algorithm. Sometimes you can't connect with that for whatever reason. I've had that happen before, too. Seems like more things have to be right. But G722 is a great fallback because it works almost universally. I mean, I've got two telephones on my desk here that speak G.722, and you get 7.5 kilohertz of audio. The noise floor is a little higher. Tell me, from an audio perspective, what is the difference that you or your affiliates or the end listeners hear when you have to use G722 instead of an AAC codec?
Well, you're going to miss a little of the crispness on the high end. G.722 codec, as you said, is good to about 7.5 kilohertz. Remember that a lot of AM affiliates have an NRSC bandpass, or excuse me, an NRSC filter that stops the audio above 10 kilohertz and pretty much is a pretty harsh brick wall between 9 and 10. I noticed it in our uplinks because remember that as the sequence of events happens for a network broadcast, you have the codec on site, which is my access. It's arriving at the flagship studio. There's a compression algorithm involved there. Then as it leaves the flagship studio and goes to the uplink on another IP codec, there's another compression algorithm there. Then as it goes on the uplink itself, the digital uplink, and is uplinked to the satellite and then back down to the satellite receiver at the affiliate, there's another compression algorithm there. So it behooves you to have the highest possible algorithm that you can have leaving the venue so that as the compression cascades, it cascades downward, not upward.
That is an excellent point. An excellent point. And some of your affiliates, I don't know what the agreements say, but some of them may be streaming that audio. So there's could be a fourth algorithm involved.
Exactly.
There. I'm a little bit curious. And I don't know much about uplink facilities. Maybe Chris can chime in on this. Would it not be possible for the uplink facility to specify, hey, if you will send us blah, blah, blah codec at this bit rate, we won't recode it. We won't cascade it. We will send that up without recoding it. Is that possible? Is that a thing?
I'm not sure exactly, because having not been in an uplink facility personally, other than just dealing with them on the phone, perhaps maybe Chris can speak to that.
Chris, what do you know?
Early on, you couldn't do that. Today, with some of the statistical multiplexes, you have that ability, but it takes a lot of infrastructure moving about, because if you're a network and you're doing distribution, the last thing you want to do is do one-offs of your uplink data streams to the satellite or to whatever internet delivery you're doing. So I would say, is it technically possible? Yes. Do some networks maybe offer it on certain occasions? I'm sure they would. But for the most part, it'd be very logistics heavy trying to make that work in a reliable manner.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But most networks will ask you for a certain level of algorithm, you know, certain encoding rate, so they can guarantee that they know what their network encoding might do to it. So they can, you know, they go for the highest. So if you're, you know, if you're on the digital networks, they'll go for the highest encoding they can, and they make sure that you offer the highest to them. So it keeps it going. I mean, the hardest part is just making sure the encoding is done properly with microphones and sound and complex audio and what you're doing.
Tim?
It has a lot to do with the mix that you send them. You know, you can have the greatest codec path in the world and not have any degradation or compression. But if your mix is sorry, you're going to lose listeners anyway. I do know that from experience with a previous uplink provider, I actually found that they were not uplinking us at a bit rate that I felt like was acceptable. And the reason that this manifested itself is I do contract engineering for several stations. And one of the stations that I contract for is a Vol Network affiliate. And their owner, knowing what my other job was, said, our broadcasts sound awful. And when I started asking questions, I found out that we were at a very low bit rate of uplinking. And when we changed uplink providers a couple of years ago, I'm happy to say that their chief engineer and I had a conversation directly on the phone. He said, look, I'm going to give you 64. If you want 96, come back and ask for it. And I've listened to our downlinks, and with that particular algorithm and the way that the and it's an XDS platform, the way that their coding worked, and the XDS receiver has actually delivered a very nice product to our affiliates.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And Tim, I wonder, you mentioned as you go from one link to another, you really if any of the early links is a low bit rate and there's grunge in the audio and artifacts, it ain't going to get any better down the line.
It's going to get worse.
I'm wondering when will we get to the day? And I mean, I've seen this happen before. Not only with Telos gear, but other brands too. When will we get to the day where you can pretty easily send linear audio from the stadium back to the flagship station, and then the flagship station can send linear audio to the uplink. And it's only the uplink where satellite bandwidth is precious and expensive, where you really have to have your first coded audio. You think we'll get to that point anytime soon with linear audio?
I think we will, because you mentioned earlier about our IP-based codec system that's here at WOT. Here's my game plan for my IP charting for the various consoles. if we could arrive at the point over a long distance that we are able to accomplish with our IP routing inside a studio, yes, I think it's very possible.
So yeah, here behind me, I've got, and I just use this as an example here, I've got a Telos Zip 1, and as an experiment, and this has been several years ago, my goodness, this has probably been 6 or 7 years ago, one of my colleagues, well, our guest a couple weeks ago, Brian Jones, he's got a Zip 1 at his office in Washington State. Brian loves Christmas music. He's got a great selection of it, and said, hey, you know what? Let's try sending linear audio Christmas music from you in Washington State to me in Tennessee at 2.5 megabits per second, and let's just see how it goes. He sent it to me for 8 weeks, and I never heard a problem. And we just both have home internet. So I was really amazed and pleased with that. And there have been a number of broadcasts. The company I work for, Telos, has done helped the Cleveland Philharmonic Orchestra to do linear broadcasts over some gear. We helped back in the Sochi Olympics. We helped Swedish broadcasters get linear audio from Sochi, Russia, back to Sweden, and that was not a real codec involved. It was some AOIP equipment, and so it was actually cheaper. But perfect linear audio from one point to another. I'd love to see that the day when we can get that. And if we get fiber connections to press boxes, surely this bandwidth would not be a problem, and we could easily just send 2.5 megabits per second back to the home station. What do you think, Tim?
I would agree. Our flagship station has installed fiber, and I know there's fiber on campus. So we get those two together, we might be there sooner rather than later.
Chris, you work at a fine arts station. How's the possibility from doing linear audio for you when you go on remote?
If I can get the bandwidth I need and the latency and jitter everything the way I like it, I've tried it a couple of times. I mean, many years ago, I was working with a radio network that we had several of our music shows that were being produced, and codec to codec was, it was linear, T1 bandwidth, T1 speeds, yeah, and we were doing linear. We had to make sure that the pipeline was stable, but it worked well many years ago, and I've done it a couple of times since then. The hardest part is with IP. It's not the codecs per se. I mean, most codecs they are built very well, all the brands, so I'm not going to pick any particular one. The hardest part is the in between, making sure that connection is robust, but properly managed, I'm going to call it. Because I can tell you, you got these marketing folks saying, I got gigabit speeds for you. Here's your business grade. And you get it, you test it, like, dude, this is not even a gigabit. It's like 30 seconds of latency. What the hell is going on here? But download's great because that's what they focus on. We need both directions. I always tell people, I want a symmetrical IP. What? Give me 10 megabits symmetrical and be happy. That's all you want? That's all I need. The gear starts spinning and the lights go off. They explode. They're like, what are you talking about? Because everyone's so used to 50 meg down, 10 meg up. Because who wants upload? You don't need upload. It's all about the download. In broadcast, it's about the up and down. And I keep telling everyone, you got to look at both sides. You got to have both.
And in our world of
100%.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tim.
I agree with Chris 100%. It's the determining factor is going to be the link between the two. Fiber is I think going to solve a lot of that, but there are a lot of places where fiber simply is not available.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've had fiber connections too. I've had bad fiber connections as well.
Have you? Have you?
Oh yeah. It's not plug and play. This technology is not plug and play like some people might want you to think, even though we're in a do-it-yourself world. you really need to understand the concepts of encoding, decoding fiber. In the case of light, you need to understand on Ethernet or Metro Ethernet, if you want to call it that, or there's like 16 other names for it. You have to understand how it's going. How many hops? Is it going through switches? What routing tables are you using? I mean, I've had ISDN over the years. ISDN circuits just suddenly stop working. I'm like, what the hell's going on? And call up. Thankfully, in the day, you could talk to someone at the phone company and actually talk to the switch guy and say, hey, this is your switch. What's going on? I don't understand why I can't make this connection. Calls back, yeah, the routing table got altered because we were doing an update. Something as simple as a routing table in ISDN can keep you from getting connected. Meanwhile, you think it's your SPIDs, you think it's your... It's not. Same is true in IP. You can have a routing table issue. You can have an ACL table issue, and all of a sudden you're like, I don't know why we're not connecting. We were doing fine about 20 minutes ago. Oh, yeah, we did an update on the iOS of the switch. Sorry. Yeah, these are things you need to sort of learn to find the right people, make sure you're prepared for it. And as Tim points out, if path A has trouble because of sudden changes, well, then path B should be the one you have full control of. So if you have a Max Connect, you have full control over that. At least you know what's going on. Or you have a POTS codec, you know what's going on. You have control. And whereas path A, you may have partial control because it's a, say, a venue IT department or a campus IT. That's how you have to look at this stuff. You know, years ago when we called the phone company, they did all the heavy lifting. All we did was plug in. They did the rest. Now you have to do everything from soup to nuts.
Yes. Yeah,
and
true.
Tim knows exactly what I'm talking about because I've done as many remotes as he's done and continues to do. And I know when you get that venue, you're talking, how many hours? When's the game? 6 hours? Okay, I got 5 hours and 10 minutes to figure something out. Got it. All right, so that's how it works. That's how we do remotes. I mean, I've done stuff for networks. When I worked for the network news, we did stuff, man. Talk about, going to the network, going to air. We got the top of the hour newscast. We got to be on the air with 400 affiliates. Are we ready? Yeah, we'll be ready in a second. Meanwhile, look at the clock. Hey, look at that. There goes the queue tone. Oh, look, the net queue is coming down the line. And we go to the sounder, and boom, there we are live on location. Yeah, and about 30 seconds before that, we were still plugging in cables.
Oh, man.
That's just part of the game. That's the nature of the beast.
Nail biter. Nail biter. And the last thing I would add is that a lot of times, because it's been convenient to, we have assumed, hey, if we get way more bandwidth than we need, then we're probably going to be okay. If we have a gigabit speed up and down, probably we're going to have at least we shouldn't have localized or last mile problems. But you could still have problems at connection points on the internet. And as I've mentioned, I've been having to do some kind of long distance STLs at two of my radio stations, and we ended up having to crank in forward error correction on an Omnia MPX node in order to and quite a bit of buffering at the receive end in order to overcome packet loss. We would lose anywhere from 12 to 50 packets out of every 1,000 packets. So that's not a huge percentage, but we had to have some forward error correction and frequent keyframes as well. I think we're going to continue to see more expansion of those capabilities in codecs, and certainly dual network capabilities in codecs. If you have two networks and you have enough time to buffer for both of them together, that seems to increase the reliability markedly, but you may end up having some latency, a large amount of buffer time for both networks, to have packets arriving, or at least when they should. Hey, we got to take a quick break here. And Tim, I didn't warn you, so I'm going to give you a quick warning right now. After I talk about my friends at Angry Audio, we're going to do a tip of the week. So, Tim, we haven't gotten much to WUOT, but if you've got a tip for us, or please think of a tip for us, and tell our engineer friends who are listening or watching something that they can walk away with and maybe even put to use, a website, a technique, something that you found out that, like, holy cow, this is really helpful. And Chris always has a terrific tip of the week. So that's coming up. This Week in Radio Tech, episode 501 with Tim Berry and Chris Tobin, is brought to you in part by these guys, my friends at Angry Audio. And this is the Bluetooth audio gadget. Oh my goodness. This is what you need in a studio where you want to let your announcers bring their cell phone in and safely, easily, and in a high-quality way connect it to your audio console. Now, this thing operates in two different Bluetooth modes. One is a bidirectional mode. So if you want to bring your cell phone in and use it as a telephone hybrid, you want to do an interview, no problem. You just pair it with this Bluetooth audio gadget, and it will, if you're in a phone call, it'll pair up in the bidirectional mode, and you'll get the best audio quality that you can through a Bluetooth device and into your into your audio console. It's going to be your phone hybrid, and you can put people on the air. You can do long-form shows, short-form shows, take quick phone calls, and by golly, this works. But the other thing you can do is long-form or a unidirectional connection. So if you've got music on your cell phone that you want to play on the air, you can do that. And when you connect in a unidirectional mode, you get a higher quality connection. This is what Bluetooth allows to happen. And it's just about transparent when you're in that high quality mode. So you got songs on your cell phone, got them stored there. You can play them right out of your cell phone and into your audio console. You can also do the other way around. You can use your cell phone perhaps as a recording device. You can get audio from your audio console into your cell phone just through Bluetooth. Now, if you've got a wired connection available, you can use that as well with the Bluetooth audio gadget. There is a jack right here on the front of it where my finger is right there with the phone icon. You can plug your phone into that if your phone has a wired connection. But if it doesn't, or if you just want to use the Bluetooth, there's the Bluetooth antenna. It's got a pairing switch right there. You can put it in the pair mode. And anyway, it's awesome. On the back, you've got audio ins and outs, analog and AES as well. So check this thing out. It's the Bluetooth audio gadget from angryaudio.com. Yeah, so much better than taping your phone to the microphone. It sure is. And remember, when you're placing your order, maybe you use these things. I'm sure Tim Barry has some of these. These are RJ45, which is real standard in the AOIP business to carry analog or AES audio out to XLRs or quarter-inch tip-ring sleeve, whatever you need. For every one of these adapters you order, and I've used probably hundreds of these, ask for your free Cat 5 cable from your dealer. Just tell them, hey, for every one of these I'm ordering, I want my free Twirt Cat 5 cable. It's a real Studio Hub cable, Studio Hub certified patch cable. It's shielded. It's all good to go. It's even got a printout of the pinout for Studio Hub. So check it out, because Angry Audio is your source for Studio Hub. Thanks a lot, Angry Audio, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris Tobin, in your perch high above Manhattan, maybe you've got a tip of the week for us.
The tip of the week, since we're talking remote outside broadcasts, is this. You have the cables, so you've got cables, all kinds of cables and connectors and headsets and everything else. And how many times you end up heat of the moment, suddenly have to figure out what's going on. My 24-channel Mac, I'm like, wait a minute, there's something I missed. You know, I don't know what's going on. Each end of those cables should have on it a colored piece of tape. You should wrap a piece of colored tape around it. So when you're hollering out to your assistant that's at the other end of the cable, you can tell them, where's the blue cable plugged into? And you'll know. Or you could use numbers. And consider that. Because I have worked on several events recently where the crew I was working with, there was a contract job, none of the cables were labeled. You know how they figured out what was on stage? They pull the cable at the sound booth. They were pulling. Which one's moving at the milk box? Which one's... I'm like, are you kidding me? Really? This is how we're going to do it? We've got 72 pieces of instrument. Are you kidding me? So just to point out, you should label the cables, whether it's a color code or whether they're numbers. And if you do with tape, coloring the tape, you know, and even number tape, don't pull it tight because it stretches. Then the glue comes off and it leaves a little furled edge. Guess what that does? It slowly unfurls because it catches things in the environment. Type it around through three times. Take a pair of scissors and snip it nice. No tension. And it will last much longer than just yanking on it and snapping it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Both for the numbering system and for just colored tape. Well worth it. I'm sure Tim already has his stuff done, so this is old hat for him.
That is a great idea. That's a great idea. Thanks, Chris. Always just good little ideas. They just make your life easier. Tim Barry on the spot with a tip of the week for our listeners. Tim?
I'm going to inject a little humor, Kirk, if that's okay. Actually, absolutely. I told you this story when we were on the phone. This comes under the Know Your Plant category. Know your plant. Have this stuff, you know, as close to being photographic in your memory as you can. The incident that I will point to is a not too long ago incident when we actually had live people overnight. In which I was awakened in the middle of the night by one of these said overnight people who was probably not completely sober, who said something to me of the effect of, hey, man, I think we're off the air, man. Well, you know, I'm, you know, trying to wake up, trying to rattle the rocks into place. And, you know, the first question I ask is, well, what makes you think you're off the air? Well, because nothing's coming out of the speakers in the control room, man. So once I'm a little more awake and I have the tableside radio, I turn it on and dial up the frequency of the station that the guy was on, and I hear silence, and I see a stereo light. Well, knowing my plant, what that meant to me was, okay, the transmitter is on. It hasn't called my pager. I hear a carrier. I see a stereo light. My stereo pilot is being generated by the Orban at the studio and sent over the 950 megahertz STL. That tells me that my STL is good because it's passing the pilot tone. So at this point, I'm thinking it's not likely that the processor's completely failed, because if it did, it would probably take the pilot light with it. So yeah. logical thinking, the next question I asked was, are the meters moving on the console? Long pause. No, man, they're not doing anything.
Okay.
Why don't you try playing something? So I hear him pull a CD out of the CD rack. We had Denon CD players at the time, so that dates the story a little. He inserts the CD into the player. I hear him grinding, you know, using the select knob to get to the right cut. I had all of my CD players, as well as anything else in there, wired for Logic Start. So when he hits the on button, the music is so loud over the telephone that it hurt my ear. So I moved the phone back away from my ear. This is, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. By this point, my wife, God bless her, is awake. My daughter's probably awake. And eventually the music turns down. He comes back to the phone and goes, "Oh, thanks, man." Click, and hangs up the phone. Problem solved. I knew my plant. I knew what to expect, you know, when a problem like that arose. And I did, you know, speak with his program director the next morning.
I think we all have those kind of stories.
Yeah, we all have those stories.
But you're absolutely right you're actually correct to point out, know your plant, know where things come from. And that stereo pilot light can be a real help. If you know what your plant is, you can determine what's working and what's not working, if that thing's present or not.
Well, it saved me a trip into the studio. And like I said, I have a very patient and kind wife. She's put up with this now for the better part of 30 plus years. And, you know, you have to, but I'll say this. My father was a funeral director, and I was used to seeing him get up in the middle of the night and deal with people at the absolute worst time of their life. And if that taught me anything, it taught me that if I am awakened in the middle of the night, I'd better be cognizant and I better know what's going on. And in this case, it helped me solve a problem without having to leave home.
Perfect. Yep. I know what you mean. Been there too. And thank you for describing that so well. Hey, it is time for us to say goodbye. Tim Berry has been our guest, chief engineer, WUOT-FM. And we didn't get to talk about WUOT. So Tim, I'm at some point, I'm going to invite myself over to your place. Maybe we should do a show from your studio, from your studios.
I would be honored to have you.
All right. Hey, we got to wrap it up. Suncast says it's time to go. Chris Tobin, thank you so much for being with us from the 15th floor overlooking Manhattan. Appreciate you.
My pleasure, Tim. It's a pleasure. Thank you for being on with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks a lot to Suncast, our producer. Another great show. Thanks for carrying it, getting it produced very well. Also, Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. Thanks a lot, Andrew. Hey, we're going to be back next week with another terrific edition of This Week in Radio Tech. Tell your friends, subscribe on YouTube. That'd be great. And we'll see you next week. You take care. Bye-bye.